welcome to MotoPod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 534. I know we've been gone for a while, and I keep saying this, and we keep coming back, and I always go, hey, it's going to be better, it's going to be same. But we haven't really improved, so we apologize about that to everyone. But we do have an update. We are making moves. We have been asking people to come on the show, getting new hosts. And joining me today is one of those such people. So everybody, let's hear it for Andrew Kors. Andrew, how's it going?
Hey, Skylar, thanks very much for the intro. Yeah, I replied a while ago to your request for additional hosts. So I threw my name in the hat and it was great to get the call. So here I am trying to help out and row the MotoPod boat along.
Fantastic. So why don't you give us a bit of a background on who you are, where you're from, and how you got into this whole motorcycle racing thing?
So I'm British by birth and lived in the UK until I was about 20, and lived in Brussels in Belgium for 5 years or so. Came back to the UK, lived in Calgary in Canada for a number of years, and eventually have ended up now settling in Switzerland near Geneva for the last 8 years. Pretty keen motorcyclist, I think, since my parents first told me I couldn't have one. So that just sort of really got the ambition burning. And then I think quite young got into watching World Superbikes, which was a big in the UK during the mid-late 80s and into the 90s. And following some of my favorite riders through World Superbikes into MotoGP at that time. So for me, I think motorcycle racing and even F1 as well has been a pretty regular thing. Coming back to Europe after living in Canada, I got into doing a lot of track days. So got a bump into Motolen, Len Padilla. So he's someone I cross paths with from time to time. It's good to just catch up with him and talk bikes. And he was someone who helped put me onto the MotoPod and MotoPod podcast. So that became a fairly regular listening for me, just to kind of get more information and more background of the races I was watching. So it's something I've been enjoying now for a few years. And it's just great to have an opportunity to, you know, to chip in and help out. You know, I think it's a great effort. So I know Harry is just, you know, getting inundated with more and more work. And it was just getting down to yourself and Harry. And like I say, it was just a great opportunity to come and help out. I'm hoping, obviously, being more based in Europe, that I'll be able to help out with some of the European World Superbike races and BSB races in the future. You know, cover those and be able to balance that off with your knowledge of Moto America and the MotoGP as well. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, so like Andrew had said, I think going forward, what we're going to try to do with the show is have people who are specialized in a certain series. That way, it's not always 7 to 9 hours of racing that you need to watch in order to report about it and make an hour show. So it's good that we're going to have people in different time zones to be able to connect with each other and be able to take a look at more in depth in a series. So thank you for your time. And welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
All right. So first bit of news, we got a little bit of listener feedback. This is from, this is from Peter Newell. Peter just written in a few times. I know that for sure. He writes, "Hi guys. Over the past couple of MotoGPs, it has been great to see Joe Roberts' performances as he gets to grips with Moto2. Coming into Moto2 with a championship in the 600 superstock class, Moto America, it seems like a huge leap, but he keeps, but he looks to be adapting well and improving his qualifying and finishing positions. So, fingers crossed, he gets a chance at one of the better teams next year. It reminded me again of Dorna's involvement with Moto America, with the stated intention of creating a pathway for young American talent into the MotoGP career pipeline. Superstock 600 as a class seems to be a good cost-effective way to get lots of new talent on the track and act as a development series. I will admit to the fact that I don't follow Moto America racing as much as I should, stay up to date to their current comings and goings, but I sure have not heard or read any further evolution of the Moto America plan or racing class structure change that would put American talent into the ridership window for Moto2 teams. So after further web surfing in search of more information on the subject, I thought I should give you guys a shout. His questions are, does Dorna have any plans to work with Moto America to get American riders over into the European or European National or for MotoGP series? Will Moto America be doing further development with Dorna on putting in place new racing classes that more closely mirror European classes? Does Dorna have any plans at all for US racing? Does Moto America have its own ideas getting Americans over to Europe? Love the show, Miss Martin. Yeah, I think we all do. And getting behind Harry's new career as Airwaves Master Blaster Moto Caster. Cheers, Peter Dole. Peter, thanks for writing in. As far as Dornick and Moto America go, one of the things I do know, I would say I think is rumored now, but has been coming up, is that the KTM class they have now is going to switch over to the 300 Supersport, much like the Supersport class that runs with World Superbike. This is an effort to get more riders in, because I think one thing they noticed when they did this class is that it alienated a huge part of the up-and-coming talent in the United States, that if you go to any local club racing, you will see a ton of, which used to be pretty much the Ninja 250 class, but is now the 300 class. There are lots and lots of riders and lots of kids that are doing that series, and not everybody is based on the KTM. And if you also notice that the European class, European World Supersport 300, actually, I don't think at this point has any KTM, so definitely it does not have a direct transition into that. So I think that's one of the changes they're making. As far as sending Americans over to Europe as far as racing, I'm not sure if there is transition. Dorna may be trying to help set that up, like I said, with maybe the 300 classes their way. Right now, I just think with Moto America, they're focused on improving the brand before they really are focused on sending young talent over. There is a lot of young talent here, but I think they may be wanting to keep that to try to bolster this series before they start decimating it of its talent, and by that decimating the competition and decimating the viewership and the racing. But that's just one man's opinion, so I'm not, you know, as far as that, they may make moves, but I will have to dig into that a little further and probably talk to Scott about that, because he may be more knowledgeable about that as well. But that's as far as I know, that's what's going on with Moto America and Dorna.
Yeah, and I haven't seen anything, read anything specific about Dorna's future plans. I mean, they've talked about some of the work that they wanted to do with World Superbikes and some of the ideas they have there, but I haven't really seen any specific plans, like you say, of bringing, you know, creating a bridge or a pipeline for American riders to come over into the MotoGP type series. You know, I agree with you that I think Moto America is still a very new series, and it's something that I think needs to get established. I think part of the step of moving riders from any country, whether American or other ones, is getting American companies and sponsorship behind these riders. Because I think we see that, especially for Moto2, a lot of riders are having to come in with sponsorship or money in place to help them secure that ride. It's not just pure talent, unfortunately, that's getting people these rides in Moto2. So, you know, I think within states, I hope Moto America will also help get American businesses into looking a little bit wider and seeing MotoGP and seeing what an exciting series it is, and wanting to be part of that, and, you know, allying themselves with American racers. I think, you know, that idea of sponsorship is key, I think, of bringing American riders over into the European series.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, talk about sponsorship, because something I'd even forgot to write down on my news is that the Mean Moto team, which is Josh Herron's Superbike team, they actually didn't go to the last round, and they had cited, well, they're having a bit of a bickering about rules and such after what happened in Sonoma and Josh Herron and Roger Hayden and the penalties he's incurred this year. But they also had made light to the fact that they lost a major sponsor at the end of last year that they thought was going to be there for this year, and so the money hasn't quite been there for the team as well. So like you had pointed out there, Andrew, they need to bolster up the sponsorship outside of basically Monster and Red Bull and what the factory teams have, because there isn't, like you said, a lot of big American sponsorship in the racing season or racing series as of right now. So I think you are spot on by saying that, like, you know, they need to have the money to also bring with them when they come over to be involved in the championship. That might be something that Dorna's looking into, because if they figure the riders can bring over those companies, it's also, you know, money and attention that can be brought into their sport from America as well. But that's, you know, that's just the beginning of the news. So with that, we'll just go straight into the news. Okay, so Tom Luffy is moving up to MotoGP, and he's going to join the Mark VDS squad along current Moto2 championship rival Franco Morbidelli. You know, Tom has been in the Moto2 championship for quite some time, and I think with Zarco moving up at the age of, I think he was 31 when he came up, it just kind of shows that maybe he laid the groundwork for saying that, hey, you don't have to be extremely young, you just got to be a talented guy.
Yeah, I think this is exciting for us in Switzerland here as well, too, to watch Tom Luthi move up. I mean, we've always hoped that he would snag a Moto2 championship. And he's always been up there in the top runners. But I think, you know, it was good to see him, too, getting tapped at the age of 30. I think often we think that, you know, people from Moto2 are only going to move up when they're really, really young. And these sort of excellent talents. So it's great to see, you know, a slightly more mature head heading there to Mark VDS to partner Franco as well. I think the two of them together figuring out, you know, how to adapt their riding styles from a Moto2 bike to a MotoGP bike as well is going to be really interesting. I think Tom Luthi's already had some time on a MotoGP bike as well. So it'll be interesting to see what he makes of the new tires as well.
Yeah, and with Tom Luthi moving up, of course, that has left his seat open. But as was confirmed this last weekend at Silverstone, that is going to be taken over by Sam Lowes, who is going to be moving back to the Moto2 Championship. The Intermittent team, along with VR46 and others, they're looking to get the KTM frame for next year. So, you know, I think it's a strong move for Sam to go to that team, because that team has been, since the inception of Moto2, they have been a front runner. And with the KTM frame, I think next year, you know, you've seen the development that Bender and Oliveira have done with this frame and how good it's gotten just over this year. Having somebody like Sam on that frame too is beneficial to KTM as well. So I think it's just a good move around for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of hard watching the train wreck that was Sam Lowes, and with all the rumors and everything in MotoGP and the way he was treated by Aprilia. You know, I was reading stories that his crew had practically seemingly given up on him by sort of November or something, you know, his first couple of tests on the bike. So to be in that environment must have been brutal. So, you know, it's great news to hear that he's at least found a really, really strong ride back in Moto2. I'm also encouraged as well because, 2019, I think they moved to the Triumph engines. So you got to figure a big company like KTM is going to be really well positioned to be able to, you know, design and engineer a new frame to take most advantage of that. My guess is kind of like the smaller chassis manufacturers, Kalex, Suter, if they're still there, Tech3, are going to be a little bit slow on getting up to speed with the new engine.
Yeah, no, and like you said, you know, with Speed Up and all those guys, it was kind of a, when you saw that happen in the beginning of Moto2, everybody was there because everyone was at, you know, ground zero, so everyone had a chance. But now it's a much more refined thing. It's just, you know, the frame's going to have to adapt to the new engine. But I think the amount of data a lot of these guys have will allow them to adapt quickly. But the manpower that KTM brings, like you said, is going to be beneficial to them for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's somebody else moving up to MotoGP next year. Who's that going to be, Andrew?
Well, this made me so happy because, you know, one of the things we've really been lacking MotoGP is an Asian rider for, you know, a regular Asian rider for a long time. So I sort of go back to the days, remember Haga and people like that. So this made me really happy to hear that Nakagami is moving up now into MotoGP. He was going to join the LCR Honda team alongside Cal Crutchlow as they now run the second bike. I don't know if we heard, will he get the same spec Honda as Cal?
You know, I'm not quite sure. Now, Cal, he became a factory rider this year, and this was kind of the writing on the wall that he was making room in Lucio Cecchinello's checkbook for another rider to come on because the team can pay just one rider. And so now that Cal's being paid by them. So, but I don't know if this brings the spec Honda. Now, I would assume that since, you know, this is a little bit a national pride, especially with having, you know, a Japanese rider on a Japanese machine, that even though he may not get the same spec, he's going to get the same spec.
Yeah, that's kind of what I expect, too. Like you say, you know, Honda, I think, are going to want to support the rider. And they've definitely got the engineering depth, I think, to manufacture, you know, the number of parts that they need. I know Cal sometimes was almost like their lead development rider, sometimes trying out parts, it seemed, on race weekends ahead of Marquez and Pedrosa. But so, yeah, I agree. I'd expect to see Nakagami on a pretty high-spec bike.
Absolutely. So there's going to be another race in the calendar for next year, and that's going to be at Thailand. And actually, they signed a 3-year contract, so they will be around until 2020. The races are going to take place at the Buriram Circuit, also known as the Chang International Circuit. What's interesting, though, is Chang is actually the sponsor of the circuit, and they're a major beer company. It's kind of like the Budweiser versus like Miller or Coors here, because Singha is the official beer of MotoGP, and the two had to come to an agreement for them to work out for MotoGP to visit this track, because as you know, World Superbike visits this track as well. So they're going to be bolstering up the races in Thailand, which is great for you know, that part of the world, because that, like we said, that part of the world sells a ton of small bikes and scooters. When I went to Vietnam earlier this year, the amount of scooters I saw, there's hardly any cars. The amount of bikes is ridiculous. It's like taxi cabs in New York. You think you see these movies and like, that's an exaggeration, and you're like, oh no, it really is like that. There's thousands of two wheels out there. So it's good to see that MotoGP is now, and they've been doing a lot of promotional tours out there in Thailand and Indonesia and things like that. And Indonesia's now even trying to have MotoGP come, I think, in 2020. They just have to get a track that is up to MotoGP spec. But yeah, good for that part of the region to have MotoGP coming out there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like I say, it's great to see, and it's great to see some of the other like Thai riders as well coming through the lower series as well. I mean, I think this is all good for the series. You know, there's sometimes that sense that you know, the history of MotoGP has been sort of focused in Europe, and I think you know, Asia is like a big up and coming market for this, and this sort of may offset the balance a little bit. But I think it just brings new energy. It's going to bring new sponsors, new you know, companies and money, and all of this is good for MotoGP.
Yeah, and if we could just get a race back to like South Africa or somewhere in Africa, I think we can cover just about every continent at this point, and it could actually be a world championship, truly. But
yeah, you're right. Another South America round, or South Africa would be fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. So more people on the move. Bo Benschneider, the current Moto3 rider for the Red Bull Akiyao team, is going to be jumping over to Tech 3 and Moto2 for 2018. I think this is a good move for Bo Benschneider. I mean, he's been showing, especially in the second half of this year, that he, you know, he's up to pace, up to snuff, and he's got a lot of talent. But I think he's just a bit too big for the Moto2 bike. So moving up to Moto2 with the Tech 3 team, I think is a good move for Benschneider.
Yeah, agreed. Get an opportunity like that, and I think Tech 3 have proven themselves over past seasons. They have an eye for spotting talent. Sometimes even when we think that they haven't made the right choice, some of their choices just have a knack of coming through. So yeah, it's great to see him moving up onto the bigger bikes, and yeah, I'd expect him to go well. And again, you know, it's good for these riders to come up a year early, just position themselves well, again, for that motor, you know, for the engine change in 2019, when we go to the Triumph engines, where, you know, the established order will all be mixed up, and they can really take advantage, I think, of, the new engine in 2019.
Yeah, they're not going to have to learn a Moto2 bike. They're just going to have to learn new bike. So that's that's actually, like you said, that is a good move for riders, especially if they see themselves going to Moto2 in the next season or two, to get up sooner before that big change comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of change, there's going to be they were introduced this last race at Silverstone. There was a new pit lane bike swap rules have been introduced, where they now have markers on the ground where the riders need to bring their bikes back into the pit, and also where the second bike should be positioned. And this is going to eliminate the famous Marquez bunny hop, where they jump from bike to bike. And also, there's going to be, because of the crash of Iannone and Alicia Spargo, they're now going to use the lollipop F1 style thing with the mechanic, where they hand out the go or no go sign, either it's red or green or has go or stop on it, and when the rider cannot leave until they have been given the all clear by the mechanic, who's going to be responsible for a safe release. So it's a lot more rules, and I'm not sure if this, you know, nothing is perfect. It'll probably bring up some new problems, and while it solves others, but obviously they're just trying to limit the amount of damage that can happen at pit lane. So, to go along with the helmets and the speed change, just another safety factor in the bike swap.
And it still seems like they're experimenting. This is something I think they had planned to try at the end of free practice too. For this, I mean, they had the safety commission, the riders involved as well. There didn't seem to be any consensus from any of the riders about whether this is a good idea. Depending on who you spoke to, it kind of varied from, oh, it's a great idea, from, you know, typical Cal Crutchlow comment just saying, it's stupid, it's every man for himself, you know, we shouldn't have any rules. If you crash, well, it's your own stupid fault, and so on and so on. So you're right. I happened to watch the end of free practice too, partly just because I wanted to see a little bit how this worked. And we lost now the Marquez kind of jump from bike to bike, but he seems to have invented a little pirouette move that he's got to go from one bike to the other as well. So even he's been working on this, trying to squeeze, you know, those few tenths of seconds out of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what these guys are, right? It's finding those last few, any advantage they can find, they'll take it. So I wouldn't be surprised if Marquez comes up and somehow figures out some kind of flip to get over to these things. Whatever he's going to do to gain half a second, he's going to put the time in to figure it out. All right. Bradley Smith moved to the KTM team last season and kind of made a development rider, but also because they wanted two young riders to come up and, as the bike progressed, have fast riders that were dumb. So, unfortunately, though, after the Red Bull round in Austria, Mika Kallio put in that 10th place finish ahead of both the factory guys, and that got KTM reevaluating the performances of their current rider lineup. After they evaluated, they gave Bradley's crew chief the boot and brought in the replacement crew chief that Kallio was using for testing and for the race at the Rebelring. And rumor also has it that Bradley may have been given three races to improve, where they were going to give his seat to Mika and send him packing. So I hope that's not necessarily the case. I think he's put in more than enough to get them where they're at. And Bradley's always been known as a very smart guy, and he's put in the time to develop that machine. So giving him the time to get up to speed, and they saw Mika's performance over one race, and like people have said before, like, yeah, well, he didn't get a ton of testing, so that's a true performance. But try doing it five races in a row, okay? You knew the track, you knew the setup for that track, so you were just working on getting faster because you didn't have to set the bike up too much from what you already knew. But let's go to three, four in a row, different varieties, different weather conditions. Then let's see the improvement, because that's what these guys have been dealing with for the last year or two. So I would still give let Bradley finish out the year before trying to, ruffle his feathers a bit.
Yeah, I agree. It's been hard to sort of see Bradley struggling this year. It was interesting that when they were initially recruited to KTM, KTM took the two Tech 3 riders. They took Smith, they took Pol, and there was a sense that already at Tech 3 you had two riders riding the same bike. They had very similar riding styles, and there was a sense that it was a really smart move by KTM to take two riders with similar riding styles, such that they could quickly develop the bike, in a single direction. You didn't have two riders with two different styles pulling it in two different directions. But I know, Bradley's been riding injured, especially early in this year, in a struggle, but he just doesn't seem to be able to get a handle on the bike in the same way Pol has. And then, yeah, I mean, there was some comments too. I think it sounded like when Bradley did a little interview, he was fully expecting Mika Kallio to kick his ass at the Austria round there. I think he even said that realistically, Pol got lucky by his brake lever having that problem that he couldn't finish the race, because Bradley seemed to be fairly convinced that Mika was going to kick his ass as well. So, I mean, we'll get to see what this really looks like. I think coming up, I think Kallio has a wild card at Aragon in end of September, I think that is. So we'll have a better sense of what the performance is. And it'll be interesting if they do bring Mika Kallio in. I don't know if they'll offer Bradley the test rider. Would he take that as a role? Who knows?
Yeah, it'd be tough to be, go back to something like that. But, Bradley's been around for a bit, and maybe a test ride is, where he'll be. But at the cutthroat rate that GP is now, I can't see any seat really opening for him unless he's bringing money to a team. So,
Yeah.
and we'll have to just see how that one
Agreed.
plays out.
Yeah.
So, Carol Abraham is going to stay with Aspar for 2018. The team's actually been happy with his performance. I've been impressed by it. He's done better than I thought he was going to this year. And the team thinks so as well. So they signed him for next year, and he's going to stay with his current teammate Bautista. Although Bautista's likely get a 2017 Desmos Sedici, and Carroll will just be staying on the Desmos Sedici 16. So, this is good for Carroll, good for the team. That's kind of a win for everyone all around there.
Yeah, I agree. It was hard watching him in World Superbikes. I kind of thought, after World Superbikes, we were just going to see him disappear somewhere. So, when he got the ride back in MotoGP, I was kind of scratching my head a little bit like that. I wasn't sure what he was going to do with it, but he has done well. I mean, he's really taken the advantages. And, for Aspar as well, I mean, you must be said, Carroll comes with a nice steady paycheck behind him too. So that helps Aspar as a team, I think, put some predictability into their year for 2018. So that's going to help them out. And I think those two together, Bautista has had moments of brilliance on the GP17. Is he 17 or 16 this year? But, he's been riding that bike really, really well.
I think he's on the
So, yeah, it's
15,
good to see.
actually.
He's on the
I
15.
think he's on the 15,
Holy.
yeah.
Then he that's been really good, because he really has had some good results money hasn't crashed this year as well. So for him to step onto a 17, seeing how that's already running this year, that could be really interesting. So that's good to see. I mean, it's just good to see, like I say, any team having some sort of like solid, predictable future there, so they can really get going and have a good year.
This is some other news. Jorge Navarro, the current Moto2 rider for the Federal Oil Gresini Racing Team, is actually going to be staying for next year. That's good. He had a tough start to the beginning of the year. Injuries and the like, and just trying to get used to Moto2 all at once held him back, but he's slowly been making his way towards the front, and he's a regular top 10 finisher. So I wouldn't doubt that the former Moto3 standout is going to be quite a contender next year in the Moto2 Championship, especially, well, you know, I would say losing two big guns like Morbidelli and Luthi jumping out, but bringing Sam Lowes back, that's not going to make it any easier for these guys who are already there. So it's good that he's staying around. And then final bit of news, Motegi has now signed a new contract to stay on the GP calendar until 2023. And I don't know about you, Andrew, but I'm always happy to see that Motegi staying on the calendar. It's one of my favorite tracks. It's a track that's been around forever, so I'm glad to see that it's sticking around for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like from the fans' standpoint as well, you know, they get such great attendance and such great enthusiasm. It's just fantastic to see. Yeah, it's always good to watch.
Yeah, and you know, they have to stay in Japan of some sort. I could never see a MotoGP season without a race in Japan. They would figure out a way to modify one of those tracks. That would just be, that would not make the factories very happy if they didn't have a race there. So good on Motegi and good on Dorna and all those for getting that signed. All right, well, unless, you know, I said that was the last bit of news. Unless you have anything else to cover, I say we jump on down to the Moto3 race.
No, I think that was pretty much all the main stuff before the Silverstone Grand Prix. So yeah, let's go ahead and talk about the Moto3 race.
So getting into the Moto3 race, one of the questions that I know I've been asking this year, and Harry's been pointing out as well, is we said after the last race that Bellega was actually going to, he worked on his starts on the after, was it the test at the Red Bull Ring. He just worked on his starts for the whole time. I think they were down in Misano, maybe. I don't remember. I'm not as knowledgeable as our friend Harry Lloyd. But anyway, he was working on his starts to getting that first bit on cold tires and a full gas tank. And so we wondered at the beginning of this race if he was going to come good. And he had a pretty decent start, but not too great. And so I want to take a quick diversion on something that made me think about what's going on with Bellega this year. And I need to check the stats, so I should have done that before the show, but whatever. That Bellega, I wonder when Fanati left the team, if that's when Bellega's drop-off started. Because with Fanati not being there and showing his results this year, he might have been the person that was kind of getting that bike dialed in, and Bellega was piggybacking off his setups, and that might have been the whole confrontation that Fanati had in the team, because when Bellega started beating him, that's when you started seeing the anger kind of come out of Fanati and the hot-headedness, and that's why eventually it led to blows in that team, figuratively and literally. And now that Fanati's gone, the team has obviously, you've seen it, has taken a down to the rider performance. So I'm wondering if that's some of Bellega's problem is that, you know, he's a young guy and he might not have the knowledge of getting the bike set up, or he may not just gel well with who's setting his bike up, or they may not understand what he wants from the bike when he says it's doing this or that in any corner or straightaway. But I just hope that, you know, he can get that figured out, because obviously when the bike is good, he's good. And so this year it doesn't look like the bike is that good. And maybe that's why he's sticking around another year in Moto3, because the boss man there is like, hey, you know, you got the talent, but you need to learn how to communicate setup so we can give you the bike to get you onto something comfortable so you can get to the front.
Agreed. And this was always, in my understanding, this was the point of the Moto3. Part of the point of the Moto3 was to get these young riders to start working with teams with bikes that are very configurable, where there's a lot that you can change, and to start building that rapport that they have to build for their future racing career with their chief mechanics, with their teams, being able to vocalize and put that into words about what they need changing and, you know, how they're feeling the differences, and feeding that back. And like I say, this is all sort of, you know, part of that process. And it's part of that complete package, I think, you need as a racer. And I think, you know, an extra year, hopefully he'll find that. Hopefully he will, you know, he'll start to have a better sense, and they will have understand him better as well. So yeah, I agree. I think, you know, this is something that he can work on for another year, and let's see how his results improve.
Right. So we get going to the race, and right away, it's a scrap from the beginning. There's like a line of 23 bikes within 3 seconds going around. It was nuts. There was nobody leading the race for more than a lap or two. Everybody's swapping. You get guys like DG Antonio who came all the way from like 13th to be up to the front. It didn't matter where you qualified to seeing this race. Everybody was running this huge freight train and everyone took a turn at the front. And for the most part, everyone was racing completely clean. There was a few people running wide, but for the most part, you didn't see anything sketchy unless you're Gravar. He ran off in the grass and just kept it pinned and got back on the track sideways coming over a curve while he was making his transition. So that was a little sketchy. But as we got down towards the later half of the race, we saw Joan Macias, who's still filling in for the injured Brad Binder. He had a crash with about 12 laps to go. And then DG Antonio blew the corner, and you're thinking, oh, it's race over. It's done. You went back to 18th. It's going. And then the race battle continues. Now Canet's coming up for the lead, and he's coming from way back. And now you've got like the main contenders in the championship all together. And then all of a sudden, Marcos Ramirez drops out of the top. And you're like, oh, no, that's too bad. And then, we're still looking around, like, okay, it's getting closer, it's getting closer. And it's like, all right, we have one lap to go. Who is going to take this? And then unfortunately, we have a red flag because Guevara had a crash with Bobby Schneider. And Bobby Schneider walked away, but Guevara gone down. I had not been able to check in to see what his injuries were, but they did have the red flag because he had to leave in the ambulance. And I don't think he was able to get up on his own power. So he may have taken a knock to the head or something like that. But it was a fantastic race. It's probably one of the best races in Moto3 this season. It's always hard to pick out a best in Moto3 because there's so many races that are so close. But to see 23 riders split by 3 seconds with about 10 laps to go. Yeah, that's a pretty good race.
Yeah, and I think Silverstone lends itself to that. It's a very wide track. There's nice long straights where everyone can start using the slipstream and positioning themselves. It starts to become a real chess game into the latter laps, to try and position yourself for that, that last final lunge in the last few corners. So yeah, it's a great track to watch that. And Moto3 is always spectacular racing.
Absolutely. So that led us down to the results. Eric Kennett got the win in front of Enea the Beast Bastianini, who had a nice race. He came from way back to come up there and kind of get one. This is also when we're doing the count back for, because we had a red flag, so we had to go a lap back. Jorge Martin finished third. It's great for Martin. He's been dealing with that injury, and he's slowly making his way back up. He led for quite a bit of the race, so good for him. Followed by him in fourth is Gabriel Rodrigo. Followed by Juan Mir, our championship leader, his teammate Livio Loi behind him, Romano Fanati in seventh, Minho eighth, Philip Otto in ninth, Fabio DG Antonio in 10th, Tatsuki Suzuki in 11th, Adam Nordin in 12th, John McPhee in 13th, Nakarant, oh, Adarat, who was that? I had to get it. It's like,
Ain't a bad.
I've been practicing this, like, oh, wait, stop, put it in. All right, but finished Martin, finished in the point scores of 15th was Manuel Pagliani. So, oh yes, and then of course in 16th, outside the points, he had a good beginning of the race, but Nico Antonelli slipped to the back, and well, he's staying in Moto3 next year, which is good, but he's not going to be on that team. So he's had a tough year, and maybe like me and Harry talked about a few episodes ago, which probably was like 5 months ago because of our recent ratio, that we had said that Antonelli going to a different team may be good for him because maybe he's just not gelling with the Aki.io team. Alrighty, so that gets down to our championship standings. Juan Mir is still leading. Got a few points, not as many as you'd like, but he did gain extra points over Fanati and Aaron Canet. And actually, Aaron Canet moved up to second in the championship with his good results. So we got Juan Mir leading off, Aaron Canet, Romano Fanati in third, Jorge Martin in fourth, Fabio DG Antonio in fifth, John McPhee in sixth, Marcos Ramirez in seventh, even though he had the crash. Andrea Minho in 8th, Enea Bastianini in 9th, Philip Otto in 10th, Guevara, Blega, Loi, Suzuki, Rodrigo, Bubba Schneider finish out the top 15. So some names there down to Blega, like we said, and then Antonelli. But these are all guys that are, like I said, they'll be back next year. I wouldn't be surprised if, another year or a different team is going to put these guys back up in the top of the championship. So things may look different next year, but Juan Mir this year is just looking unstoppable, and he led a lot of this race, and last couple laps shuffled him to the back a little bit, but still there was times that he looked even super dominant in this race and almost had a bit of a break there for a little bit, but they were able to reel him back in.
Yeah, Juan Mir is just looking fantastic. I mean, with that points lead as well, every race he's into now, for the remainder of the season, he's just got that in the back of his mind. He's got these points in hand. He doesn't need to necessarily push for the win. So he, you know, he can just ride for a second or for a third, you know, just to take the points with an eye on the championship. So he's all that hard work early in the season's just given him this great advantage now.
Right. And a side note to our very own Harry Lloyd, when I had to ask about Patrick Pulkkinen, and he said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, you won't hear his name very much. I've heard his name every single race now. Postman Pat keeps coming up. So he's gaining popularity with the announcers. And he must be like one of those guys in the paddock that everybody loves. So I have to make sure I keep his name relevant in the conversation because he does keep coming up. So that was kind of a funny thing I had noticed.
Alrighty. I think the tag, Postman Pat, yeah. The commentators are going to love that.
Right. I was like, can the postman deliver today? They're just waiting for him to have a good ride. I know they've got that joke on the shelf somewhere. They're just waiting for it.
All right.
So moving on to Moto 2, you know, this was, we were looking for the usual battle. But in warm-up, in qualifying, we had our usual front runners that we had, Tom Luthien, Morbidelli, Alex Marquez, Matteo Pessini. Nakagami, though, didn't have the greatest qualifying. But in morning warm-ups, he was showing that he was running at pace that if he was able to maintain this pace for the race, that he was definitely going to be a contender for not only a podium, but possibly the race win. So, let's see, where is he? Okay, so in the beginning of the race, we had Pessini wheeling off the line, and it was a bad spot because he was from pole, and I think he dropped maybe 6 or 7 positions, if not more, right off the line, wheeling and then almost running way to the right and cutting across the entire track when he did it. So it was a bit of a sketchy moment for Pessini off the launch. And then we had Luca Marini, who's going to be going to the VR6 in Moto 2. He ends up taking Manzia. I have that in my notes as a side note. Sorry, that's something else. I say Marini is just going to Moto 2. He's actually replacing Manzi. So the Mark VS riders at the very beginning of the race ended up pulling away. It looked like it was just going to be Morbidelli and Alex Marquez. They must have, I think, probably by the first three laps, probably had a gap of like about a second and a half to 2 second gap on the rest of the field. And you're thinking, oh, great, it's another 1-2. These guys are going to just pull away, put in cruise control to the last 5 laps, and then duke it out with themselves. But that's not quite what happened. Because once Taka Nakagami got around the continuing pack, he started pulling away and slowly started chipping away. It was 3 seconds. Then it was 2.5. Then it was 2.25, and then it was 1.8, 1.7, 1.6, 9 tenths, he's coming. And he started bringing everybody else with him too. So the guys at the front were losing a bit of pace and everybody else was getting faster. So this led us to our friend Marquez, who was battling with his teammate. And what happened to Marquez, Andrew?
He crashed. He lost the front and he went down. It's, you know, the two things you always see is you see Marquez going down and then you see the instant cut to the pit wall and the team, and they're all, their hands are on their head, and there's that kind of look where they're like, oh no, and then it's like, oh, not again. But then, you know, this really set it up because now you've got Nakagami closing in on Morbidelli, pulling everyone else with him, and everyone now is also sniffing the podium as well. So you could see there, the front runners there was like pushing on, all starting to sniff an extra podium place.
Yeah, and so here comes Nakagami, and we're thinking like, okay, he burned up his tires getting there. There's no way he's going to be able to run up pace. Gets around Morbidelli. Morbidelli goes, oh, this guy's not in the championship. Well, at least it was maybe what we thought. And then you see Nakagami just pull away, running a lap pace that no one else could even touch. So now you're starting to do the wonder, and you're like, can he keep it together? Can he run it? So then, now here comes Tom Luthien and Pessini. As they're coming up, you're thinking, okay, are they going to catch Morbidelli? And they do. Then Pessini gets around both of them. So now Pessini's taken off, and as he goes down there, he's starting to run out and talk to Nakagami with about 2 laps to go. And so they cut to the pits, and there's Nakagami's sister, like, fingers crossed, eyes look very concerned. She's like, come on. Because the last one, Nakagami, I think, was had us under a red flag in like tricky conditions. So, you know, he needs that solid, dry win. And what a way to bolster that contract signing with coming out with the win of that weekend. And it's exactly what he was able to do. Cross the line in first, about half a second in front of Matteo Pessini to take the win. And you won't see much joy out of Nakagami, but you saw a lot of joy when he crossed that line. It was almost probably more relief than joy, I would say, at that point.
I think you could see it. I'm sure under the helmet he was in tears. I think initially I wasn't sure if he was going to be able to hold on. I thought he'd, burned up his eyes trying to close the gap to close down the gap between Morbidelli and Marquez there. But unbelievably, he still had it and he was able to lead it and hold it all the way to the finish. It was a really impressive ride, and especially on the back of the news. Some more cynical people would think, like he's all signed, sealed, and delivered. He doesn't have to work now. He can just keep himself healthy for next year.
Right, he did the opposite of Jonas
Yeah,
Folger. He went out.
exactly.
Folger signs, takes a dive. Nakagami signs, he's backup winning. So good for him. So I'm gonna go and clear up my little bit of the beginning there. I had stumbled over my own notes, but I just wanted to point out, like I said, Luca Marini was going to be going to the VR6 Moto2 team next year. He is actually part of the VR6 Academy, so it's just kind of a lateral move for him, but he's going to be relieving Stefano Manzi of his seat. Manzi's had a bit of a struggle this year, and we can all see that he probably wasn't going to return that team this year, but it's not surprising that someone from the VR46 camp is coming. And Marini's had a pretty decent year. He's, regularly up there in that top five, top eight kind of area. He hasn't really challenged the podium too much, but maybe with a bit of a better bike and that team, he can get up there. Also during that race, I just
Yeah,
want to
and I
point out.
think,
Oh, go ahead.
and I was going to say too, I think Sky Racing team as well, their focus is giving up and coming riders opportunities, and they have some big brand name sponsors and some big budget behind them. I think if you come into that team, you really have to do well. I mean, that's the expectation. I think doing well is just not good enough. I mean, I think you really need to come in there and sort of blow the lights out. They give you an opportunity, and if they just feel you're not performing, I think there's other people ready and waiting to get that same crack at that opportunity.
Right, it's much like the Red Bull KTM team in Moto3. It's a double-edged sword, right? On one side, it's like, yeah, it's a great opportunity. You've gone to a top team. It's probably your best chance of getting wins, or one of the best chances to get a win in that particular series. However, like you said, the pressure's on. The well isn't that deep. You can only step so far down before they start going, "Hey, man, we've got other guys that are they're itching." So, that pressure might even get to some of these guys that maybe when they go to different teams, they can, ease up. But yeah, it's definitely a high performance team, and having the boss's name on the side of that bike probably doesn't help that attention thing as well either. So, yeah. So let's just run down through the order here. Like we said, Taka Nakagami gets his first win of the season, followed by Matteo Pessini, Franco Morbidelli in third, Tom Luthi came back, but he finished in fourth. He faded towards the end. He definitely did burn up his tires, but still had a strong fourth. If that was considered a bad day finishing fourth, I'm pretty sure most riders would take that. We had
Yeah,
Tech.
he was trying for the podium though. You could tell he was
Oh
pushing,
yeah.
but the tires were gone. They just weren't there.
No, he ran out of it. Bagnaia finished a strong fifth for him in his rookie campaign. Simone Corsi in sixth. Stefano Manzi in seventh. Just when you lose your seat, that's when you step up. So there he is with the top 10 finish, actually finishing ahead of Marini. So good on Stefano there. Miguel Oliveira didn't have the best of race for the KTM. They just seemed they couldn't quite hit the setup this weekend, but he had a finish in eighth, right in front of his teammate Brad Binder. So whatever setup they hit, they must have hit it right about the eighth and ninth position. Dominic Agutter in 10th, Luca Marini in 11th, Xavier Verhey in 12th, Jorge Navarro in 13th, Alex Marquez finishing in 14th after he remounted after having his low side crash and he was very frustrated about, and Axel Pons completing the top 15. Couple of notes just outside top 15 was Fabio Quartararo, who's still dealing with the wrist injury. Hafi Sairing finishing in 17, and then after that, it's just pretty much the usual suspects. Joe Roberts in 21st as he still gets the grips with the Moto2 machine and the European tracks.
Yeah, it
So.
was good to see. It was good to see Remy Gardner finishing a race, just gathering experience and knowledge as well. So it's like because we've had his father interviewed on the show, so it's always good to just keep an eye on Remy and see how well he's doing.
Right, and as far as finishing, we only had two guys go out, and that was Sandro Cortesi and Iker Lukuona, who crashed out in the race. But I mean, for as fast and as hard as that race was, only two guys out, that's pretty good. Well, we also had a crash from Marquez, but he got it back together. So that leads us down to our standings. Franco Morbidelli is still our championship leader. He extended that over Tom Luthi, and so he's in front of, he's at 223. And so Tom Luthi in second, Alex Marquez is in third, Miguel Oliveira in fourth, Pecco Bagnaia in fifth, Still, remember, this guy's a rookie. He's going to be a contender next year for sure. Matteo Pessini, outside of a few bad races this year, and we could probably say this for his whole season, or anybody that wants to say this outside of a few bad, he had a really good season. But like we said, if not for a couple of crashes, you know, Matteo, you know, he's just like Dovizioso. Fine wine gets better with age. So good on Matteo Pessini. Taka Nakagami in 7th, jumping up a few spots after that strong win. Simone Corsi in 8th. Dominique Agutter in 9th, Luca Marini in 10th, Javi Verhey in 11th, Jorge Navarro in 12th, Hafiz Sayre in 13th, Brad Binder in 14th, and Marshall Sartre in 15th, followed by Baldassare, Quartararo, Cortesi, Pons, Simeon, and the rest. There's like another 15 guys down that list that I don't think we need to run through. Alrighty, and that brings us into MotoGP qualifying. Now, the qualifying for GP, I just said we want to get to the race because that was pretty exciting. But the couple of notes about it is that Danny Pedrosa and Jonas Folger had to move on from Q2 or Q1, whatever it is, the order they do them in, from Q1 to get to Q2. They were the two that made the jump. Alex Rins actually was making much improvements. He, for a while, there was actually leading Q2 or Q1. And that's good on him because not only is he making improvements, you'll see later in the race he did better than a teammate. Alright, so getting to Q2, the most exciting thing here was the number 159. Now, Johnny Ray was there doing commentating on for the world feed in, I think, FP3. And he was saying that he believes that someone was going to drop below the 2-minute mark, which hadn't been done before. Now, if there was somebody who's really good at cracking records, who would you say that might be, Andrew?
I think it was Marquez. I think Marquez before, you know, he woke up in the morning, I think he had that on his radar. He wanted to go under 2 minutes. There was a sense, I think, that he, you know, he wasn't going to be happy until he had done that.
Absolutely. And you know, he went out there. The first dry run he gets, he cracks like a 2:00. It was a 2 minute and 3/10.
He was already so close. I mean, That's him sort of laying down the gauntlet. Him saying, this is what I'm out here to do. Like, if you guys want to play, come play.
Yeah, it's like his first flying lap, too. It was absolutely nuts. Like, the guy is just... That's a very Casey Stoner thing to go out, run a warm-up lap, run the next lap, set the record. All right, going home. Pack it up, boys. So, yep. Marc Marquez gets pole with a 159.9 in front of Valentino Rossi, who almost broke the 2-minute barrier. He ran 2 minutes. 0.025. I mean, that's a slight wiggle out of a turn, and you're under the 2-minute barrier. But it was good to see Rossi.
Well, I thought it was impressive to see Rossi up there in second too. He was looking really strong and really competitive. You know, the Silverstone, you think, is a fast track. You know, I was expecting to see the Ducatis up there. You know, so to see a Yamaha up there in second, so that was definitely showing that they had the pace. They had the pace for the race.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. I thought that, you know, this was going to be another a Ducati track because of long straightaways and that the turns, you know, they're flowing, but they're very open. And so I didn't think the Ducati was going to struggle too much in that, but we'll get to that later. Cap Crutchlow having a strong show in front of the home fans, finishing third in front of Matt Vinales. Jorge Lorenzo, another decent qualifying for our favorite guy to make fun of, it seems like, lately on the show. Andrea Dovizioso in 6th, and pay attention to that one because we have Danny Pedrosa after that, Johann Zarco, Aleix Espargaró, Jonas Folger, Paul Espargaró, and Scott Redding rounding out the rest of the runners in Q2.
It was good to see Jorge, though, up in 5th. I know people have been sort of like, you know, sniggering a little bit, but, you know, you don't have to think back that many races when he wasn't even in Q2. He was sort of falling out in Q1. He was well down on the pace. And, you know, slowly, bit by bit, he seems to have found something with the bike. He seems to have found some confidence. I know adding the wings has helped. I think they did a one-day test at Zai before coming here, and that helped him find confidence, because we know he is a confidence rider, and that's what he needs. And that just extra setup time seemed to really, really help him there. So for him to just pit Dovizioso, I thought, you know, by qualifying 5th with Dovizioso in 6th, that was interesting. I was thinking, okay, this could be interesting for the race to see him up there. If he can look after the tires, you know, he's there near the end.
So that leads us into our race, which was Rossi's 300th Premier Class start, Bautista's 250th, I think, career class start, and it was a good race. So why don't you lead us through it, Andrew?
It was a good race. I mean, first things first, it was dry.
Yes.
you know, which is something you want to see. You know, a nice fast flowing track like that at Silverstone, you know, you want it dry. They'd had a little bit of rain on the Friday there, so it was good for the race, and that was great to see. The other interesting thing too was on the grid, we're seeing from the tire allocation, pretty much everybody, certainly the front runners, were on hard front and hard soft, except one notable exception, and that's Vinales. Vinales came to the grid with a soft on the rear. So, you know, that was causing consternation with the commentary team as they're trying to figure out how that's going to work. And I think it also meant from the start, we were expecting Vinales to have to go out hard and make the most of that soft tire to get the advantage at the beginning. But it didn't quite work out like that, did it?
No. He actually ends up, dropping back a little bit at the pace. And Rossi's the one on the hard, jetted out to the front. And then it was up to Vinales to kind of run him down. And you were thinking, oh, no, he's going to run him down. And he started to. And he's going to burn up his tire. And that's going to be it from Vinales. He's going to get spat out to about fifth place because he's got no rear left. He's just going to be spinning coming to the race. But not necessarily the way it went.
No, Rossi was on it right from the beginning, like a great start. And then he had the lead out of the first corner. And he just really got on it on those hard tires. He just seemed to find the balance of, getting the pace down, but not being too hard on the tires. It was interesting to see Marquez in the early laps trying to chase him and trying to keep with him on that pace. Almost lost it, I think, coming out one of the corners. The rear tire wasn't quite up to temperature. He got on the gas hard. And I mean, for him, it was probably no moment at all. But, you know, watching as a spectator, I thought he was going to get launched. But, you know, he got on and then he just set about just channeling and chasing down after Rossi. So I think there was kind of an initial group of about like seven riders. We had like a Rossi, Vinales was in there, Dovi, Lorenzo was in there as well, Cal, definitely. So there's like a group there. But, Rossi was just got the hammer down and just started to try and put in those fast laps to build a gap.
Yeah, he did build a pretty decent gap there for a while, but until he started getting run down. And this is where you started seeing where that Ducati advantage actually started kicking in, the one we expected in qualifying because of the huge straights. Like, would the Ducati be, faster because it had that top-end speed? And it started to show its head with Dovizioso about halfway through the race when he started running down Rossi.
Yeah, for sure. I think Dovizioso just, went off for an even start, make sure he had the heat in the tires. And then you could see him. He was just generally sort of working his way forward. He passed Lorenzo pretty early. And then he just started working on Crutchlow and Marquez and Vinales and just sort of moving himself into that position. I think he was just happy just to sit there for a while. I think, as long as he felt that Rossi wasn't getting too far away, he was just happy to sit there and try and manage the tires, because I think very quickly as the race settled down, you began to realize that this is really what this is about. This is about managing the tires. And it was interesting watching Vinales, because Vinales there was trying to push, trying to close down the gap. And he was struggling even with the soft tire in the early stages. He couldn't seem to match Rossi's early pace and couldn't quite close down that gap. But equally too, his rear tire didn't seem to be going off. So like he was sat there just pulling the group along, I think, and gradually picking up and closing down on Rossi.
Right. And so with about seven laps to go, here comes Marquez breaking down after a long straightaway, and then boom goes the engine.
I don't think anybody would have expected that. I don't think anybody expected that. I can't remember the last time a Honda blew like that in such spectacular fashion. Luckily, he's on the outside of the track. He's able to just run wide onto the runoff of the corner. So, there's no fluids down. They didn't have to stop, because that was another worry that they're going to have to red flag because there might have been oil on the track. But he kept it to one side. But then that's it. Now the championship takes on a whole different complexion, because now that he's at the end of this race, he's not going to be leading the championship anymore. So now the focus really came down, didn't it, between to Rossi and Dovizioso.
Right. And so, when Marquez's bike blew up, he blew up right in front of Vinales. He got a face full of smoke and probably some oil, because we saw, Marquez's bike a little squirmy afterwards. But then here comes Dovizioso. And they've been, talking about his braking, how excellent it was. He's running down Rossi. And they come down, I think it's the hangar straight, and they come down and both are having a braking duel. And it was definitely a game of chicken. I think there might have even been someone looking over left or right shoulder just to see if the other guy was still there under the brakes, Dovizioso tips it in the corner, and that was the last time Rossi really saw him. He led the whole race except the last three laps. So a bit of a tough pill to swallow.
It was it's almost like Dovizioso just hit some turbo boost button or something at the beginning of the hangar straight, because, you know, that cop shot, you just see how much distance that Ducati closes up on that straight to put him in the position to be almost alongside as they start the braking. And, you know, Dovizioso is a famely breaker, and Rossi is always strong into the corners like that. But it just seemed inevitable. I don't know why. It just seemed the pace and the momentum that Dovizioso carried into that corner. And then he just went about pulling away. I think all the tire he'd saved earlier in the race, he was able to deploy now. And he just pulled out a gap on Rossi. And now the question was, you know, where's Rossi going to finish? Because you could start to see this last few laps now, you know, he's losing his pace and the others are coming for him. So Vinales is coming, Crutchlow's coming. So, you know, Crutchlow too is sniffing, maybe a third place in this now that Marquez is out. So he was starting to. As well, so those last few laps were starting to get really exciting, and of course, we still have to bear in mind that Vinales is still on the soft tires. So, again, you know, is this going to go in the last lap as well? So, was Crutchlow going to come through and take both of them to finish second on the podium,
right? And then, you know, we had all thought, like I said, Vinales had blew it up, but he started to make his move. He started running down to Vizioso, he was pushing hard, he was getting close to setting lap records himself. As he pulled into the Vizioso, he looked like he had the pace to pass him. Which would have been two different things, catching and passing, always two different things. But it looked like he made his move one lap too late, because he definitely got on the back. He was close to Dovizioso right there at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he was a little bit surprised himself, almost how much rear tire he still had. You know, I think it felt like he was just pushing and pushing and pushing, and, you know, the tire was staying with him, and that was just encouraging to give him a try. But equally too, I always felt that the Ducati just had that little bit extra in hand on the straights if he needed it. And that would just stop the Yamaha getting too close into the braking points. So I think, you know, Dovi was just pulling on all his years of experience, and he just looked so in control. I mean, he just really looked like he had the measure of that race. It was an impressive thing to watch.
Yeah, a bit of an Iceman this year. He doesn't seem to get frazzled. If he's back a few spots, no big deal. He knows how many laps he has, and he's kind of like a boxer. He knows when he's going to pull his punches, and he knows what round he's going to lay it out there. So he's been having quite the season. You know, he's the guest alien this year, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But, somebody, you know, we had a great finisher, Dovi, but one guy didn't have too good of a finish in that, or too good of a finish, and that's Pol Espargaró, who crashed right after crossing the finish line. They looked back on his data, and his rear tire locked up, which whipped him off the bike right there going into turn one. So, bit of a bummer for Pol, but when they asked him how he felt, he's like, "Oh, I felt good. If there was any time to have a crash, that was the point."
It's amazing, you know that they try and engineer these things to the absolute limit, and there is that sort of running joke that if it's still running when it crosses the line, we've over-engineered it. But I mean, that is ridiculous.
Yes.
This notion that they've tuned it exactly, that the second corner after the finish line is just going to lock and go down. I think there were some crashes too before that. I think I saw Iannone unfortunately wiping out Petrucci.
Yes.
As Iannone lost the front into Stowe.
Yeah,
he was down.
Yeah, he had a bit of ran there in the back of Petrucci, so that was a tough one.
Yeah, I think they kind of they had a little words I think in the gravel there, but they seemed to be friends before they got back to the pits. That seemed, unfortunately, Lowe's at his home Grand Prix there. He went down early, I think, in around about lap seven or so. I didn't quite see what happened, but. You know, for him, it just goes from bad to worse. I know he's got the Moto2 seat now waiting for him, but you know, he just think he wants to finish out the season well so he can just do a big FU to Aprilia. Don't know what you're missing. So that was really sad for him, you know, in his home Grand Prix as well.
Yeah, he had a very early exit from the race. So also in his home Grand Prix and not doing himself any favors was Bradley Smith finishing last of the runners in 17th. Another tough race for Bradley, and coming off that rumor that he had three races to prove himself, not so good for him, especially when, you know, Pol had a almost a top 10 finish. He just kind of got pipped there at the end by Alvaro Bautista. But yeah, Bradley's got to step it up. But you know, if it's a results-driven class. So,
Yeah, absolutely.
if you're finishing in the back, it's gonna be tough to keep your seat. Oh, so anyways,
And I
but.
haven't really, sorry, I haven't really read either with Bradley. What for him is the issue? Is it a lack of feeling? Is it just that, the tires getting eaten up and he's just not been able to deal with that? I know he's not doing well. I know he's been riding with injury, but yeah, it'd be interesting to see with the new crew chief. I don't know if they're going to have some more testing time upcoming. That yeah, if they can work through those problems, get them sorted. I think it's going to be tough at Misano, but maybe by Aragon, they might have something.
So why don't you give us the rundown of how the race order?
Okay, so the eventual finishes were Andre Dovizioso in first, Maverick Vinales in second, Rossi very happy to have taken a third place. It was interesting, even after having done all that work in the little Parc Fermé afterwards, he seemed pretty happy. He said he wanted to be on the podium, and that's the result he got. Cal, on the other hand, seemingly finishing in fourth, a bit disappointed. I think he really thought that there was a podium there for him. He seemed to have the pace early on in the qualifying, but for some reason, just couldn't quite get the tires. I think he was complaining too that when he's following other bikes, the front tire for him just overheats, and he's just hasn't got the grip on the front that he needs. He's running the hard tire there, but he's still saying it's still not hard enough for him. Those Hondas and his braking style in particular really, really needs a higher, a strong front tire. So I can't see Michelin bringing anything new in the upcoming races. So I don't know if they can find something to help him because he's shown a lot of potential. Jorge Lorenzo in fifth. That's a credible fifth for him. He's got to be encouraged by that. It'd be interesting to see him run at Misano. I think he could definitely be sort of a dark horse to finish on the podium in Misano, especially having just finished up a one-day test there. You got to think their test settings and all the data they would have accumulated, that will really put them ahead. Zarco, a privateer. Look at that satellite bike. Well, satellite bike, not a privateer, but a satellite bike in sixth place ahead of Danny Pedrosa in seventh on the factory Honda. Eighth, great showing by Scott Redding in his home Grand Prix on the Pramac Racing Ducati. Alex Rins, that was a good result for him as well, beating his teammate. And Iannone wiped out, so he didn't even finish the race. But Rins was running ahead of Iannone for most of the race, so that was a good result for him. 10th was Bautista, 11th was Pol Espargaró before he broke in just in the first corner. Tito Rabat as well. That was a pretty good race, I thought, for Tito Rabat as well. He's, hasn't kind of been showing a lot of early form, and a lot of people were wondering what his future was going to be. So a good, strong 12th place finish for Tito was good. Carl Abraham in 13th, Hector Barr in 14th. We had Loris Baz in 15th. Jack Miller, I think he'd be disappointed with that in 16th. I think he would have hoped for more than that. And then, yeah, as we said, Bradley unfortunately bringing up the rear. So we had Espargaro from Aprilia, who I think stopped with a technical fault. Petrucci, who was wiped out by Iannone. Marquez, who we know had the engine blowout. And yeah, Sam Lowes unfortunately didn't finish, by crashing in seventh. So do you want to just run through the MotoGP standings now?
Sure. So that leads us to our standings, and the most important part here is that we have a new leader, and that's Andrea Dovizioso. And he's got a bit of a lead, 9 points, but given this season, that's a strong lead considering it seems like there's been no one that can be able to. Marquez had the biggest stranglehold, it seemed like, but after having his most recent crash, or I'm sorry, engine blow up, got ahead of myself, the other Marquez crash. Anyway, having his engine blow up, this championship, there's what they say, there's like 13 points covering the top three, 26 or so or more covering the top four, and these are all different factory bikes. You got a Ducati leading off the Andrea Dovizioso in first, Marc Marquez in second on the Honda, Maverick Vinales third, Valentino Rossi in fourth, both of the Yamahas. Danny Pedrosa still hanging out there in fifth. He's still kind of there, still not kind of there. He's gonna need some stuff to happen in front of him and have some good results towards the end of this year to really step back into the championship play, I think. Johann Zarco still in sixth place. He's having a great rookie campaign, and he's definitely putting pressure on the guys that have factory rides currently. Should anybody up there start to really slip, I think people are gonna really start to look at Johann Zarco and Zarco and, it's got to be looking at Rossi like, can you please get slower so I can have that factory Yamaha ride? Because you keep finishing in the top three. I'm not going to ever be able to jump onto that factory team because Vinales isn't going anywhere soon as well. But just behind him is Jorge Lorenzo is seventh. Cal Crutchlow in eighth. Jonas Folger is in ninth. Daniel Petrucci's in 10th. Bautista 11th. Scott Redding in 12th. Aleix Espargaró in 13th. Jack Miller in 14th. Bass 15th. Followed by Iannone Abraham, Rabat, Paul Espargaró, Hector Barbera, Ryan Smith, Pierre Calio, Lowe's, and bringing up the final point score with his 1 point in one race is Sylvain Guintoli. So yeah.
And I think we should mention that the fact that Jonas Folger didn't take part in the Grand Prix,
right,
even though he did qualify, because if I remember, he had a pretty big crash in warm-up.
Yes, he did.
Out there on cold tires. And I think although he happily was okay, I mean, he was pretty bruised and pretty banged up, so he couldn't take part in the actual Grand Prix, which is a shame because he, alongside Zarco, has been showing some great form. And it would have been great to see both the tech bikes running. But I think he'll be back at Misano.
Right. And so with that, I think that about wraps up the MotoGP coverage, unless you have anything else you want to say, Andrew.
No, I'm just excited. It's great to see three riders, I think, there. I think Rossi even himself admits now he's probably out of it. But to see, not just three riders, but three manufacturers, Ducati, Honda, Yamaha, with Dovizioso, Marquez, and Vinales up there, just within, can go anyway. So as Harry's always saying, it's the best season ever, I know.
That's right. So originally the plan was that at this point we were going to juncture into another interview, or not interview, but I was going to be talking with another host. But considering we've already gone over an hour for this show, I think what we'll do is we'll just break it down. The next person I grab will be the next episode, and so on and so forth when we set up those recordings. So just a little bit of outro stuff. You can always reach us at motopod@motopodcast.com. Go ahead, write us in, send us, your thoughts on the races. Also, let us know what you want to see from the show going forward. Do you like the fact that we're going to be having separate people for separate series, and we're going to have more of a, think of it as a news outlet where you have your weatherman, so you're going to have your BSB man or woman, or you're going to have your Moto America personnel, you're going to have your MotoGP World Superbike, and they all come back together at the end to kind of talk, topics together. We're not saying that if Andrew's our BSB guy, he can't talk MotoGP. No, definitely not that. But we're just saying when those races come up, that's the first race that he's going to watch, that he's going to report back, so we can always have an in-depth conversation no matter what the series, and we can get back out to covering all of motorcycle racing so we can get back to the standard that I know you podcasters want to listen to. So further on that, you can reach me on both Twitter and Instagram at SkylarV28. Harry on Twitter is HLPhotoGP. On Instagram, I think he's HLComs on Twitter. I really need to update this list. Instagram, he's HLPhotoGP. And then Andrew, where can we find you at?
I do have a Twitter handle, but off the top of my head, I can't remember it. So we'll update that somewhere, maybe on the Facebook page. We can put that in as well. So if you need to, you can hit me up on Twitter as well.
All right. So once again, apologize for lateness, but like I said, I may even be recording multiple shows this week. We still have to cover Lautzesring from Germany. Me and Harry, me and Harry probably get together next week. He's still, Mr. Globetrotter. So yeah. I think with that, that's a bye for me.
And it's a bye for me. Thanks, Skylar.
No worries.
That's the sound of Harry pulling the MotoPod handbrake because we have some, pardon the pun, breaking news in classic MotoPod style. Of course, quite literally 30 minutes after this show was recorded and about 5 minutes after Skylar sent me an email to say that it was all recorded, we had maybe the biggest news that we've actually had all season, that unfortunately Valentino Rossi has broken his leg, a tib and fib fracture in an enduro training accident, which is, devastating, hugely disappointing for the championship. I'm here, it's 9 p.m. on a Friday night. I'm here with that's my can of Valentino Rossi Monster Energy hitting against the desk. I would pour one out for the homie, but I don't want to get my carpet all sticky. But being slightly less facetious, it is a huge blow that Rossi will now miss. It seems both Misano, well, certainly Misano. I mean, that's in you know, 7 days from when we're recording this, and more than likely Aragon. Initial reports say that Rossi will miss 30 to 40 days. That's how long it'll take him to recover. You know, and in true sort of motorcycle racing style, you know, the usual recovery for this is much, much, much longer. So Rossi is doing fairly well to get back in 30 to 40 days. Obviously, this is championship over. They've had to plate the brake. They've actually put a big nail in it, which is quite scary. But yeah, you know, this is unfortunately championship over for Rossi. But I think that it proves just how hard Rossi was pushing for this championship. You know, I was chatting to some journalists at Silverstone, and the journalists were saying that Rossi has become obsessed with winning this title. He's been training 3 times a day, twice on the bike, once in the gym, you know, 10 hours a day, every day that they're not racing. And that, you know, when he and Uccio and all their friends go out for dinner, all Rossi wants to talk about is engines and racing. And yeah, he's become so single-mindedly focused on winning this championship. And I think that, you know, him injuring himself in the motocross and now him injuring himself further in the enduro is demonstration of that. You know, I think that it's actually a testament to Rossi that he was pushing so hard, even in training, that he did risk an injury. But yeah, you know, it's disappointing. Obviously, you know, there are more riders in the championship than just Valentino Rossi, but a four-way fight for the championship is always a lot more, well, not a lot more exciting. It's, you know, it's 25% more exciting than a three-way fight for the championship. So that is disappointing. You know, I'm sure that Rossi, when he does come back, will still play a role in the championship. You know, we know how strong he can be at all those circuits, all those flyaway circuits. I guess there's about 3 big questions. We'll go through them. The first big question, when does Rossi come back? I don't know. As we said, definitely not Misano. Aragon would be super, super doubtful. Then you have the flyaways. But my question is, or sort of my thought is, does Rossi bother to do all 3 flyaways? Because 3 races in 3 weeks with, you know, whatever it is, an 8-hour flight on average between each of those 3, that's hugely demanding on the body. And we know that from when Rossi came back after he'd done, you know, essentially the same break back in 2010, that even though Rossi was riding, he still wasn't fully fit. You know, when he got on the podium in Sachsenring, when he was fighting, I don't think he was on the podium there. I think, no, he was fighting with Stoner for the podium there. You know, that took it down of him. When he did get on the podium at the next round in Laguna Seca, you know, he was still on crutches. So I'm not sure if it's worth Rossi doing all 3 of the flyaways. You know, what I can see Rossi maybe doing is come back for Phillip Island, Sepang, and Valencia so that he's, you know, that bit more fit and can help Maverick Viñales more in the title fight, because, you know, that is now the role that Rossi's going to play. I think it's incredibly unrealistic to expect Dovi, Marquez, and Viñales to essentially, you know, lose 50 points each and keep Rossi in the title fight. So I don't think that anybody will hate me for saying that Rossi's 10th title, at least in 2017, is now unfortunately over. So yeah, so I can see Rossi coming back then, but, you know, Rossi is Rossi, and he could very well come back for Motegi and try and do the business there, as my phone goes off. And then the second big question is, who's going to replace Rossi? Could Johann Zarco move up to the factory team? Could Jonas Folger move up to the factory team? Who's going to do what? Yada, yada, yada. If there has to be a replacement, I think it will be either Kats Nakasuga, the Yamaha test rider, / now triple Suzuka 8-hour winner for Yamaha. I think that Yamaha, you know, Kats is the test rider. Kats is a MotoGP podium finisher as well. Important to remember that one from that year in Valencia when he replaced Spies. And you know, we've seen in the past with Lowe's when he won the Suzuka 8-hour that Yamaha do like rewarding, you know, their hardworking employees with a MotoGP chance. And you know, Nakasuga knows the bike well, knows the Michelin tires, isn't going to do anything stupid on the bike, and you know, could actually get some decent points. Obviously, Yamaha do have to worry still about the manufacturers and the teams' championships, so they don't want to probably put you know, somebody like Michael Vandermark on there. Vandermark, you know, he's very, very quick, but he's never ridden a GP bike. So thrusting him right up there with no testing experience, I think would be pretty damn wild. But I have been wrong a lot. And then I mentioned Lowe's. I think that Lowe's could also come on that bike. You know, we know that Alex Lowe's does have experience on the Tech 3 bike. He didn't set the world alight, But, you know, he'd only done one MotoGP test. And I think that Lowe's or Nakasuga is a bit more likely than Zarco, because, you know, Zarco's also fighting for independent team honours and the Independent Riders Championship with Crutchlow. So I would, you know, my personal feeling, obviously, is that they would probably focus on that one. But again, I could be wrong. Under the rules, you have 10 days to replace a rider, so Yamaha don't have to, in my opinion, probably won't have somebody for Mizuno. You know, Mizuno crowd figures, lots of talk of that. I'm going to assume that crowd figures will be down. You know, of course they will. You know, Mizuno is Rossi's home circuit. Whatever you want to say about Mugello, you know, Tavuglia's literally 15 minutes up the road. So, you know, that'll be disappointing that, you know, it's not quite as busy as it could be at Mizuno. And then, you know, of course, lots of people, you know, discussing and, you know, lots of opinions about the riders, the championship is bigger than one rider, yada, yada, yada. And yeah, you know, the championship is bigger than just Valentino Rossi. But I'm sure that if you're listening to Motopod, chances are you're probably going to be watching in Mizuno no matter what happens, because we still do have that incredible three-way battle for the championship. You know, Andrea Dovizioso, we saw, what year was it? It was a couple of years ago. I think it was when Dovi, it was either his last year at Honda or his first year on Tech 3. You know, Dovi finished, I think it was third at Mugello behind Lorenzo and maybe Pedrosa. And, you know, all the crowd there were chanting Dovi, Dovi, Dovi. So the Italians will definitely get behind a home hero. And then, you know, the Ducati at Mizuno, I think it could be pretty special. So there's a lot to still look forward to in Mizuno, certainly, as I now take a drink of my Rossi Monster Energy as we remember and send our thoughts to the doctor. That makes it sound, he's not dead. That makes it sound like he's dead. He's definitely not dead. Anyway, sip. But yeah, so now, the third question, and the question that has set social media ablaze: should Rossi, or any rider for that matter, be allowed to ride a motorcycle during the season? My short answer is yes, they should. You know, training accidents happen. Sure, a motorcycle makes it more dangerous, but, you know, say you're a rugby player or an American football player. You know, all it takes is one bad tackle, or, you know, for you to quite literally trip during training. And, you know, that could be a broken neck. You know, it's probably pretty brutal to put it like that, but, you know, that's how it is. And, you know, it's the same for any sport. You know, if you're a swimmer, you get a cramp, you drown, you're dead. So I think it's a bit, like, I can understand where people are coming from, but, you know, you wouldn't ask a tennis player to become better at tennis by riding a bicycle, you know? Like, to be a better motorcycle rider, you have to ride a motorcycle, you have to ride it fast, you have to try and be competitive on it. And that's what Rossi was doing when he was riding enduro. So, yeah, you know, I understand that motorcycles are more dangerous and stuff like that, but, you know, leaving the house and going to the shops is pretty dangerous, because cars kill, you know, however many people a year. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, there's a lot of people, like, really, really bashing on Rossi, and I think there's a lot of upset fans. You know, there's a lot of hardcore fans out there who, you know, if you go on the MotoGP.com article that they post on Facebook, there's at least three people who on there said, I saved all year to go to Mizuno and see Rossi battle for victory at home, and now that's ruined for me. And, you know, that's... Yeah, it's a bit weird that, you know, you're only watching for this one dude, but it's also pretty sad. You know, people have been saving their whole year to go see this, so I can understand why some people are upset. But I do think it is a bit unrealistic to try and force riders not to train. You know, they need to... Okay, not every rider needs to ride a bike to go fast. You know, guys like Cal... you know, he obviously does a lot of bicycling and not really much riding during the season, does a bit of flat track during the off season. But, you know, a happy rider is a fast rider. And clearly training with the VR46 Academy is what made Rossi happy and fast. You know, this year Rossi has been, you know, as competitive, if not more competitive, than he's ever been. And I think I can't remember what I was going to say. But anyway, we shouldn't be ripping on Rossi for training. At the end of the day, Rossi's a 9-times world champion. He knows what he needs to do to prepare for a race. I'm sure before, say, 2010, Rossi didn't really have to do much to win races in terms of outside training. But, you know, he has now realized that because of his age, because of the level that MotoGP is at, he has to train. And to him, the best way to do that is to ride enduro, is to ride flat track, is to ride motocross. So, you know, if it works for Rossi, I think that, you know, we should accept that. I don't think you can stop riders doing what they want. You know, at the end of the day, even if Yamaha do put in Rossi's contract, you can't ride motocross. Is Lynn Jarvis, you know, either himself was going to send somebody to go watch Rossi, you know, 24/7? Like, riders are still going to be, you know, riders are still going to find a way around it. They're still going to ride if they want to. And is Yamaha really going to cut Valentino Rossi's contract mid-season because he rode motocross? It's just unfortunate that, you know, both of these accidents have happened before the Italian GPs. But yeah, you know, as I said, Rossi will be okay. He's not dying, so luckily we don't have to pour out any of this monster energy, Valentino Rossi. You know, there's no need to go start mourning or anything like that. He will be okay. And you know, it's just another story in 2017. It would have been great to see a four-way fight for the championship. You know, as I said, but you know, some things aren't meant to be. And I guess it wasn't the year of the goat. Maybe next year. Who knows? I also don't think we have to worry about this injury ending Rossi's career. Maybe if you had to have an external fixator put on, like John McGuinness or Ian Hutchinson, maybe then we could, you know, theorize about that. But I think Rossi will be back at the end of the year, and he'll, you know, finish out that contract he has with Movistar Yamaha. After that, who knows? But I don't think that this injury will impact the future of Rossi much. And yeah, that's pretty much all I have to say on it. Obviously, because it was a bit last minute, and we did have to pull the old Motopod handbrake. It's just me rambling onto you. As I said, it is 9 p.m. on a Friday, so it's the end of the week. I've had a lot of coffee and a lot of energy drinks today because I was out of the office. And whenever you're with clients, it's always, oh, let's go have a coffee. So I have had about 6 coffees, and I'm basically ready to see through space and time. So excuse any rambling. And also a big thank you to Skylar and Andrew Course for whacking that show together. I think that for Skylar's first time sort of leading a show with a newbie, and for Andrew's first time being on a show at all, they both did a brilliant job. So a round of applause. That was me clapping around my microphone for a round of applause. Very good little pun there. Shout out to you guys for doing such a good job. And I'm now going to go put this show together, and hopefully it will be up before 10 p.m. UK time on a Friday. Bye, everyone.